Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Duran Jones. I'm from Louisiana, a very small town called Hillaryville. A lot of folks know me through Duran Jones and The Indications, a soul band based out of Indiana. I met those guys while I was doing grad school out there. And
you have a solo record, a debut solo record, dropping as we speak.
Yes, I do. And it's my baby. Spent a lot of years working on this thing, and I'm so proud of it.
It is a big, luxurious, luscious baby, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I think when you put a lot of time and love and energy into something, you want it to represent, you know, your whole story, where you come from, what you've gone through, your family and what they've gone through. Did it feel like almost like a lot of pressure to try to put everything of who you are into one record? Did you just kind of go song by song and tell the stories?
You know, honestly, I wrote these tunes. And I always knew I had a record. I just didn't know what it was going to be about. And so I just kind of let the universe tell me in some ways what exactly this thing would be. And immediately I got the sign that it should be about my story, my beginning. This is the first time in my music career that I've been like able to honestly and openly tell my story unfiltered. And so getting that sign, that message meant, okay, I have to start at the beginning. Where's the beginning of this thing? And in 1864. And so I had to go there and move all the way until 2022, 2023.
Welcome back to the show on the road. Thanks for being with us. I'm your Sonic Spelunker, Zach Lupitin. And as you just heard, we're going to be talking to Louisiana's finest, Duran Jones, for this week's episode. And while he has toured the world with sweet soul superstars Duran Jones and The Indications, he is branching out on his own for his new record, Wait Till I Get Over. And it really moved me listening this week. And in many ways, what Duran did with these songs is a radical act. He chose the music over everything else, over relationships, over love, over diving into the pain of the past. He let the music lift him up and take him to the stars. So I'm going to shut up and let Duran Jones take it from here. Yeah, that first track, Lord Have Mercy, which is out, people getting a glimpse of what's to come. I mean, the video is very striking. It's very haunting. And really, it's a full film. We begin and end with the fire and seeing a community go up in flames, these little kids witnessing the violence that has existed in Louisiana and all around much of this country for centuries.
Oh, my mama couldn't tell me about the feeling I feel, and I'm 49 on a Sunday morning still. Grand's all dressed up and she's headed to church, but I'm in bed tired from last night's work. So Lord, please have mercy on me.
We assume, obviously, that, oh yeah, that's a different part of our history that we've moved beyond. But really, the scars of the Civil War and Reconstruction, Jim Crow, it's everywhere. And how did that video and that song kind of come to be for you?
Man, Lord Have Mercy. It's one of the first tunes that I wrote for this record. And I wrote it while I was home in Louisiana around 2000, or the idea of it came to me around 2014 when I just finished grad school and I was living home with my grandmother, really trying to make something out of myself. I was in a very, very dark situation. At that point in time in my life, I was pretty depressed. And every Sunday morning, she would knock on my door around 9:15 and be like, "Duran, I'm going to church. I'll see you later." You know, like, she was egging me on, like she wanted me to go to church with her. But I was always so tired, and I just didn't want to go. So when she would leave, I would get up and I would look around Hillaryville. Hillaryville is a really, maybe about 500 folks or so in the really small town. So I would just look and see how the place settled into itself. You know, like, I feel like the Lord Have Mercy video really reflects on my grandmother's time while she was in Hillaryville. And when she was there, it was once a thriving business, a thriving place with restaurants and bars and hotels. And all this little, in this little small rural town in the south of Louisiana, and the aftermath and effects of the war on drugs that really affected Hillaryville. And so that's where I guess the cross line, cross wire is for me and my experience in Hillaryville and my grandmother's experience in Hillaryville, because it was such an idealistic place and so far removed from my vision or how I seen Hillaryville growing up. Even though it was the sanctuary town, they still dealt with the terror and the sporadicness of hate, domestic terrorism, and all these different things that that was always a constant thing in the back of their minds.
Is your grandmother responsible in some way, I think, for the confidence that you have to make music and to sort of be who you are?
Yeah, definitely. She was definitely the first supporter, and she took me to get my first saxophone, get my first music instrument. She was the one who encouraged me to sing and made me sing in gospel choir at church. And so first and foremost, she was the most encouraging.
That phrase, or even the idea of mercy, right? It threads its way through so many different genres of music. Obviously gospel, you know, I always remember that Aretha Franklin gospel record, and they sing, you know, mercy, 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 you know, that sort of calling out to a higher power, hoping for some sort of forgiveness, but also trying to almost forgive humanity for the darkness that it's perpetuated on itself, you know? Did you feel like this record was a processing, almost like a therapy situation for you? Like, definitely a feeling of loneliness, of isolation, and yearning, whether for love or connection to a higher power. Did you grow up religious, or did you sort of find you were rebelling against your grandmother's wishes to go to church?
I grew up religious. Yeah. I can no longer call myself Christian, but I still do practice some aspects of Christianity. I would like to say that I'm moving into some realm of voodoo nowadays, mainly because it's what my ancestors practiced before Christianity was forced upon them. But I do find that Christianity does have some great principles within it. But this record was definitely influenced by gospel music, because it was such an integral part of my life growing up. Throughout the years I spent in Hillaryville, my grandmother made sure that we always went to church, and my favorite part of church was always the music. And so it always played a really big impact for me, throughout my singing, my playing saxophone, my piano playing, all that stuff. So
a lot of folks obviously discovered you within the last, 5 years or so with the larger group, The Indications. I got to see you guys at the Hollywood Bowl opening for Nathaniel Rateliff. That was a really special night. That was the first real concert that me and my wife were like, all right, we're getting out of the house. We're getting a babysitter, in a long time. And
that's really beautiful.
You know, obviously the Hollywood Bowl is about as big as it gets. I mean, could you imagine going from playing the Soul Reviews in Bloomington, Indiana to gracing these stages where the frickin' Beatles and the biggest folks in the world are playing? I mean, that trajectory was pretty steep and pretty immediate. I mean, it's amazing to see.
Did I expect it? Not this fast, no. I remember being cramped up in like an old school Volvo. It had to be like a 1991 Volvo or something like that. Whole band's cramped in there, like all of us, and we're driving to play this place. I mean, it was like right across from Capitol Records, some little like showcase thing. And we passed the Hollywood Bowl, and I remember seeing like Herbie Hancock, John Legend, maybe like the Foo Fighters on like the marquee of like all the shows that's coming up. And I was just like, man, I can't imagine what it's like playing that thing. And then like 4 or 5 years later, bam.
There you are.
We were there. Yeah, it was a very emotional moment for me, for sure.
The juxtaposition between you and Aaron Fraser, the other lead vocalist, he's a drummer, but he's also singing in this beautiful high falsetto. Whereas, you're going a little more of the gritty soul sound. I feel like your voice reminds me of like Wilson Pickett, Donny Hathaway, just the emotion and the fear. Yes, JJ agrees. Does it feel like almost like you have two groups in one, or does it feel like, yeah, this is just a natural fit?
It just feels like a natural thing, honestly. And for me, my goal for music is for it to feel organic. I don't want things to feel forced, and I'm not that kind of guy that will be like, okay, this is my show, this is my moment, and I'm not gonna let anyone take it away from me. I'm not that kind of guy. And so it just felt natural for it to move to where it is now.
The self-titled record is great, from 2018. The song that opens the record is, very fiery, talking about, we need a change, right? Not only that, you're sort of calling for people to see the stories, the single mom with three kids working the street, seeing how it's almost impossible for people to make enough money to get by, and that, obviously wages in this country haven't risen in 35 years, right? You lead with that song, right? It's like you're not hiding it 4 or 5 songs in, right? This desperation in your voice and the brass and the organ, it's right at the top. And then to kind of soften the blow, we have the, you know, Is It Any Wonder, right?
Sweet Soul. That's
Sweet
that's
Soul. Is that what you call it?
So some people would like to prefer the term, but yeah.
But those two things lived together in that 70s world, especially Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, right? Where you could talk about some heavy shit and then be like, hey, babe, let's maybe make out in the back of the car for the next 5 hours at the park. Like, we need both.
I just feel like it's a part of soul music. It's a core essence of what soul music is about.
Tell me what's going on. When you see a lady in the streets, single mother with three kids at home, and you know her job ain't too sweet.
And I would dare to say that you cannot be a soul musician, no matter if you were back in the 70s or here in 2023. You cannot be a soul musician and not be politically conscious. I really do feel like that's something that's extremely ingrained in the DNA of soul music, to the point to where, like, James Brown found a way for people to party and get funky, all the while getting them hip to what's going on in the government, what's going on with the mob, how the mob does things and how we should do things. And, you know, like, people were dancing to that stuff, but they were also, like, really receiving information. And so I've personally have always felt like this duty or this task to always be conscious of the social systems in place that are stopping us from human rights. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, just, you know, like, there are governments across the country that are really, really restricting down on women's rights and trans rights and gay rights. And I just wonder, like, when are we going to start thinking about human rights? Like, do these people who are making these laws not consider these folks that are different from them to be just as human as them? It's like, I really would love for us to focus on who is human and making sure that that person has all the rights that a human deserves, because it seems like right now our politicians are giving us categories of who should be the more prioritized human and who should be the human thrown in the trash. And but I just feel like even nowadays, just as a soul musician, like, this is stuff that we should be talking about. And, you know, you can be serious like what's going on, but you can also be like James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud, or Mr. President, Funky Mr. President. You could be like that, you know, and really teach someone something, but also keeping a groove going.
People, gotta get over before we go under. People, we gotta get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't say what you meant, you just changed.
Well, I think, again, you said that this record starts in the 1860s. It doesn't start in the 60s. It starts way back when the fundamental question of who is human was being discussed in our government, right?
Yeah.
The reason why slavery and all these policies were set in motion is because enough people fully believed that people with darker skin weren't fully human, were not able to be considered people with feelings and worthy of dignity, right? So why would we have to pay them to work? Why would we have to treat them with any kind of kindness? You know, there's no reason. So now we go to the current policies where folks are trying to gut the Voting Rights Act. And now you have a song like Seeing It Through, which actually has this interesting spoken word intro. But you're talking about how our calloused feet have to walk over the thorns, right? Have to keep pushing things forward. And only your own belief, your own self-esteem can kind of drag things forward. And do you feel like when you get on stage that you mentioned faking it until you make it, but do you feel like you're putting on this heightened version of yourself to lead the band, or is it just sort of your most true self?
You know, I try to rise to the occasion, and I guess I say that because, it is a heightened part of myself. Whenever I'm off stage, I'm pretty introverted, and I don't wear a lot of fancy clothes. I don't put on a lot of jewelry. I'm usually a hermit in some ways when I'm off stage. Whenever I get on stage, I have to be extroverted. I like wearing a lot of gaudy stuff. I like wearing bright colors, patterns, big hats. I just like to have this big personality when I'm on stage. And I feel like that's a part of the legacy that I'm a part of and that I have to carry on. I just think about all of the greats who came before me and how they did things and how they carried themselves. And I just want to move that forward and keep it going. They laid the path for me to do what I'm doing. And so I need to continually lay the path for the ones that will come after me. And so, whenever I get on stage, I would like to believe that it's a heightened version of myself. Yeah.
I always feel with, my group Dust Bowl Revival, and we've been around for over 10 years, that a lot of times I'm not cool enough in real life to like be playing the clubs or events that we're in, right? Like I normally would be like, God, I don't feel comfortable here.
Yes.
Oh yeah, but I'm the reason why they're here. You know, it's like there's like an interesting disconnect there. Whereas when you get off stage, sometimes all of a sudden you're still not cool enough to be there, even though everyone's like, great job. You know, because I feel like it's like we're always like our 17-year-old self. Like, you know, you have this song where you're talking to your teenage self. And is there something that you, is there like one thing that you wish you could have told yourself?
I would just want to let him know that you could dream for yourself. You can dream bigger than any dream anyone has ever had for you. Don't be afraid to. Because that kid was living other people's dreams and not his own.
I think the one thing that I realized being now in my, mid to late 30s, is that you forget how to dream about stuff. You know, you're just sort of getting through each day being like, well, I'm on very little sleep with the 1-year-old and trying to get the band to get heard, and no one's buying tickets to this Wednesday show, and oh, but Friday's show is great, you know?
Yes, yeah.
You forget to like have bigger, crazier dreams, you know? Like, did you have some outlandish hope when you were a kid? Like, did you want to be James Brown? Like, what was your biggest hope, you think? Or was it much smaller than that?
back then, I wasn't too sure about what I really wanted out of life, really. I knew that I loved to sing, and I had it in the back of my mind that I wanted to sing in front of a large audience of people, but I was afraid to say that out loud. When I was in college, it took several years for my friends to even hear me sing. So yeah, it was just something that I held on the back burner, but I always journaled. And that's one thing I constantly tell my friends to do, like, yo, journal, like, really take the time and journal. And Erykah Badu said it best, like, write that shit down and watch it manifest. Talk about it and watch it manifest. There are some things that I have dreams and aspirations for years down the road, but I'm talking to my friends about it right now because I feel like just me talking about it kind of holds me to task. And so, yeah, I still hold on and I try to dream big. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about the inner child within myself because I really do feel like even though we're adults, we all still have this child within us, whether it's curious or wounded or mischievous or jovial or practical. That child is still within all of us. And I think as adults, sometimes we forget to check in with that part of ourselves and see what it wants. And so, yeah, so I've been trying to tap into like my inner child and really tap into the things that that kid was so afraid of dreaming for and really diving into what that is and how to achieve it.
When little July here was born, it was a very scary time. About a year ago, my wife almost died having her, and I would sit in the parking lot of the hospital and listen to the radio a bit when I was trying to like process what was happening. And your guys' song "Wichu" was the most played song on 88.5, the SoCal Sound. Wow. So it was on all the time, and it was just this shot of happiness that would come in this really dark time for me. And it just reminded me of sort of the power of just music lifting your spirits when you need it most, you know? And that song is just pure sexy energy, you know?
Thank you. Thank you, man.
How did you guys decide to call it just "With You" besides instead of "With You"?
I think that was Aaron. He just had this idea for this hook. He heard it on some video thing, and he just knew the rhythm like da 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 da. With you. And so from there, I took that melody and the "with you" part, and I wrote down some words and I showed Aaron what I had, and Aaron kind of flipped some things around, and that was kind of the start of "With You."
Do you remember the very first song you wrote? Like how old you were?
I was around, oh man, very first song. I mean, it wasn't a full song, but I used to love to go on like the Windows 95 and we had like this little microphone and we had like this little recording thing. And I record like this little, you could only record for 30 seconds. So I would record these little 30 second songs and then I would pitch my voice up to sound like a chipmunk because I thought it sounded so much cooler. Like I was doing the Kanye thing before Kanye was around, dog. Like, shake up. I'm just playing.
I mean, the Chipmunks Christmas album, that was like a hit on cassette. I mean, like legit, like went into number one, I think. You know, so that was playing all the time.
For real. But I had to be around like 8 or 9. I still kind of remember a little bit of it. I thought I had a good song.
All right, go ahead. Lay it on us.
I'm not going to sing that song right now.
I had this high school band in Chicago, and the first song that I really sang lead on.
What was the name of your band?
It was called Iconoclast.
Ooh, I like that.
Someone who breaks down icons and statues or something. I don't know. Very angsty. It was like alternative rock, blues, funk or something. I don't know. I wrote this song called What Makes Jane Break Down. I think it was maybe a playoff. Jane's Got a Gun, the Aerosmith song. Like this teenage girl just like flips out and starts killing people at her high school. Like that was what I led with, like first time.
Yes, like, indeed.
And my parents were like, okay.
He's got a lot of emotion.
It's an interesting choice, but it's a catchy song, so indeed. You do you.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, dude, my first band in high school was called Rayleigh's Revenge. It was a ska punk band, and we decided to name it after our gym coach, Coach Rayleigh. And our emblem was, we just felt like everyone gave Rayleigh so much shit that one day he was just going to come to school and kill us all. Because, like, he really hated everybody. And so we just wanted to base a band off of that. And
did he ever see the band live?
You never saw the band live, unfortunately. Never did. But I think he would have really liked our local big hit was called Everyone Has AIDS, which we were teenagers, you know, like we were just really some punk angsty kids. But
it is funny to me that a lot of folks, and myself included, the first band I was in technically was like a punk band, like seventh, eighth grade called Labyrinth. Not based on the movie, but on the little game with the ball bearings.
Oh, nice. I like that.
And our punk rock moment was we played the talent show and we played the Ramones Sedated was our signature closer. And the Austrian music teacher, Mrs. Swisher, was so offended at our loud guitars that she pulled the plug of the power on stage.
Whoa.
Shut us down, which was even funnier because my dad was the host of the talent show.
Wow.
So my dad's on stage and he's like, okay, folks, give him a round of applause, I guess. Here's the next act. Like he didn't back us up at all. He was like, all right, and off the stage you go.
Dang.
And then afterwards he was like, that was messed up. You guys sounded great. You know, like I was like, yeah, Mrs. Swisher was not down for the cause.
She was not down with it, bro. She was not down with it at all.
She was like, you only sing Wagner in my class. That's all we do. Okay. If you could collaborate with someone totally unexpected, who would it be? Is there someone that you'd love to do a song with?
Richard Wagner, man.
You know, he'd love to come back from the grave. No, he'd be like, wait a second. I don't work with black soul singers. Or maybe he would. I don't know.
Hey, I could let out a little, you know, Heldon tenor, a little bel canto, whatever the fuck they call it. I can do the lo, 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 lo.
Did you have to play some intense classical shit on saxophone for your graduate program?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm not as good as I used to be. Back then, I was practicing like 6 to 8 hours a day.
8 hours?
Yeah. Playing some very ridiculous, extremely tough music. One day I will get back there again. I have this dream of doing this classical music record. But as with collaborating with anybody right now, honestly, just because I really love his stuff. And to me, he's like, honestly, one of the most prolific songwriters that is still here today, Stevie Wonder, hands down. I wouldn't even have to write anything. I would just love to just sit next to him on the piano and just watch and listen. That would be a treat in itself.
Is there a favorite Stevie song that you grew up singing? I know your dad used to also sing back in Louisiana, right? He was in different groups?
No. My grandmother used to play a little organ in church, but my dad was He was a jock straight up. Like,
oh, okay.
It's so weird that I was born from his genes, whatever. Because yeah, dog, he was like basketball player, 6'3". He wanted all of his sons to be basketball players, and I was like, hell no, dude. I knew, like,
I'm too sensitive for that, Dad.
Yeah, I knew like from the time I was like 5 years old, I wanted to play music. And he was putting me in basketball, and I was like, man, come on, get me out of here. I hate this stuff.
See, this is why you can't believe things you read on the internet. For some reason, I read somewhere that like your dad was like also playing around in bands back then.
Oh, no, not my pop.
Thanks for nothing interview prep. Why did I prep by reading things on the internet? You know, his dad actually used to be an airline pilot, and he used to, you know, be a mountain climber. I'll just keep making things up from the internet. You know. Do you feel like your solo record, is it even possible to recreate live? Have you tried doing it yet? I know you have a whole string section, like in that first song, especially Jerry Marie. I mean, it is a big orchestra lifting up your vocals. It's beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Tracks, like how are you going to do it live?
I don't want, and I've told the band this because we're going to be playing a lot this year. Yep. We got coming up in May, we have shows in Bloomington. We have 2 sold out shows in LA. We have shows in New York, Chicago. We're heading to Japan later this year. We'll be doing Newport Jazz Fest, Mill Valley Festival, Bumbershoot. And there's more stuff like being in the works that is talked about right now. We're all really excited to play this music live.
So far, so free. When she smiles at me, the whole world starts to quake under my feet. And this I know, my lover.
And I'm definitely going to do it, but I'm not going to do it in a way that folks will expect me to. I feel like people have seen me perform in many ways with The Indications. And with that group, I'm just a singer, a front man. With this project, I'll be playing saxophone, I'll be playing keys, as well as singing. There'll be 2 drummers on stage, 2 drum sets, kind of like the James Brown vibe. Everyone's singing in the group. Strings will be a special occasion kind of thing. I'm really glad that you said that, you know, that string section on the first track feels very lush, because it's only honestly 4. Just violin, 1, 2, viola, cello. Some really amazing string players from the Jacobs School of Music at IU, which... arguably, Jacobs School of Music is the best music school in the world. People all over the world travel to specifically study there. And so getting some string players from there, it was just like getting world-class musicians. They were very adamant about me playing the piano and singing while they played, which was not my plan to do in the studio. It's the first time I ever sang and played on a recording at the same time. And it was a nerve-wracking experience, but it was really, really beautiful. But once we recorded that bass of me on piano singing and the 4 of them, then we had them just retrack it one more time to just make it sound fuller. And I mean, they really made it sound like a full orchestra. And I'm so thankful for those guys.
Not only that, it feels like almost like you're opening a movie, you know, like there's a cinematic quality. I think you let your voice soar more on this record than maybe your previous Indication stuff, like just letting the drama kind of come out more, you know, romance, you know. And I feel like, yeah, I didn't expect it to feel kind of like a musical at times. Like I see this on Broadway someday, somehow. Yeah.
Okay. I'll take it, baby. I will take it.
Have you ever been in an actual musical or on a dramatic show like that before?
I've done one musical where I sang and did some acting. But all the other musicals that I performed in, I was either a tech person backstage or I was in the pit playing one of the Reed books.
I don't know if you grew up listening to, you know, old school Broadway musicals. That was definitely part of my upbringing. I think most boomer parents are like, they're going to be playing, you know, Sound of Music and Music Man and all those things at you no matter what. But I never realized until I think the last few years how much that has filtered in accidentally to my songwriting, you know. The idea that you can tell a story in this big theatrical way, you know, which I think certain bands, Queen, for example, like, you know, Elton John, these are big flamboyant personalities that, I mean, they obviously have Broadway musicals now of their music, but that's not what initially they intended, but it was so big from the beginning. You know, you have a song like I Want You on this new record that is pretty out there at times. It feels like Tom Waits's percussion, is filtered in from the back door. Like the time signatures maybe changing throughout. You got a lot of weird stuff happening, and I was super fucking down. But also like, what the hell is happening? I almost like looked down at the screen like, did I accidentally put on something, a different record here? But then you have the gospel choir and the synth bass kind of come in the back. Like, what is happening in that track?
I would like to call it psychedelic gospel.
All right.
Yeah, because I initially like that song. When I play it, just me and piano, it sounds like a gospel song. But whenever I got with these guys, shout out to, I call him the MVP of this project. His name is Ben Lumsdaine. He played drums, he played guitar, he played synth. He also engineered this record and then he mixed it as well. Wow. When we got to this tune, he was like, I have an idea. Give me 1 hour, please just give me 1 hour. And so I was like, okay. And so we're just sitting, waiting, and we just hear him just like banging on a lot of stuff, just boom, 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 boom. Ah! You know, just like all this random stuff. I'm like, what the hell is he doing in there? And he creates this groove that almost feels like, it, in a way, it's like, it's almost rolling, but it feels like, it's not like a perfect circle, it's like a cone. So it's like rolling and it like goes, like it slowly rolls and it goes fast and then it slowly rolls and it goes fast. And so he really created this groove like that. And it immediately reminded me of these suits that this sculptist, Nick Cave, not the musician, but the visual artist, he makes these things called sound suits, where they cover up the entire body. They're super intricate and really crazy. And whenever you move in them, they make sounds. And he has this one wooden suit that really reminded me of that. And so we leaned into those crazy raucous drums and we tried to find the voice of it. When we started recording this tune, I was telling the band, I was like, yo, everything feels way too long. Like, we need to play our drums like they're percussion. I want you guys to play your instruments like you're filling in holes and gaps. And so that was kind of like the process of really trying to make the song work with those percussion instruments. I didn't want anybody really playing long. I just wanted filling in spaces. Play your instrument like you're a percussionist, like you're a drummer.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was really the basis of that tune. Speaking of the lyrics in terms of that tune, I Want You kind of leans itself to like a gospel lyric in many ways. A lot of gospel songs have like that vague, it's kind of, they have that vague love song vibe. It's like they're singing to Jesus, but it could really be to anybody. And so with this one, I wanted to have that vibe, but I didn't want to sing to God necessarily. I really wanted to sing to music. Because at the time when I wrote this song, I was working a 9-to-5 in a science lab of all places. Somehow, some way, I landed that job.
As one does.
Yeah. Yeah. And immediately when I would get home, I would go straight to the piano. And I would, that song was like a desperate prayer of like being like, okay, music, I've pushed every relationship aside, every intimate relationship aside for you. Like, this is, you're what I want, you know? And folks are telling me that I should give it up, or that it's not meant to be, that my voice is too loud, it's too shrilly, I scream too much. I've heard all of that shit, but I was like, man, I just want you, music, and I want you to want me the same way. So please come on, like, I'm here, like,
who told you that you scream too much?
Oh, gosh.
Listen, can you just lower your volume by 50% and then sing? Probably.
For a little while. I definitely have a really big voice. And I'm proud of it. There was one point in time where I was getting very self-conscious about it, but I've learned, especially doing this solo project, to like, actually, like, it's okay singing loud. It's okay singing with resonance. I got my training initially in college. There were a couple of vocal coaches who, when I started to sing, they would hear me sing and really implore that I would do some vocal lessons with them. And they were opera singers and they were teaching classical singing. And so the big key that I got from them was resonance. Just like, because to sing opera, you know, you just have to have,
yeah,
really, you don't have to have a big voice, but it just has to be resonant. You have to find a way to make even your sobs reach the back of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I really took to heart. And yeah, I just had to learn to like really embrace and accept that. Hitting the road really hard with the indications was a learning lesson for me, because at the beginning, I was hurting myself a lot. I didn't necessarily know. Now I kind of think of my voice kind of like a coin purse or something. Like, I don't want to like unload all of my money onto the stage too soon. I kind of pick my moments, you know, to really give it to them. Especially the older and older I get, I try to be a little more self-conscious and aware of those things nowadays. But now, yeah, there's some moments after a show where I still feel the need to like sing and really get it going. And yeah, some friends will come up to me after the show, like while I'm singing, they'll just be like, I can't believe you're singing like that after you just sang for 2 hours. And I'm like, I have to, you know, like,
yeah.
If my body and soul is calling for it and I still need to do it, I'm gonna do it. And sometimes when they're taken aback from me doing that, it makes me feel like, yeah, okay, I got something special here. Like, yeah, maybe this is a superpower of mine.
I think that a lot of folks go into playing music on the road as a happy accident, right? We didn't expect this to be our 100 days a year occupation, yeah. Right? I mean, it's a thing I've been in bands since, you know, 13, probably more, you know, full on for the last 10 years or so. But the thing is, do I have any real training in this? Absolutely not. I went to college for writing, right? I'm a writer first in my mind. But I'm also accidentally one of the lead singers in this band, and I love singing. I don't think I almost didn't even realize how much I love singing until it was taken away, right?
Yeah.
And I go to this, you know, I went to an ENT and there's a vocal health kind of a specialty at Cedars-Sinai Hospital here in LA, and they're like, yeah, you probably should have come here about 7 years ago, but we'll see what we can do for you. And the funny thing is again, you don't even realize how you talk can damage your voice, right?
Oh, yeah,
I'm supposed to be talking more up here, right? But I like talking down here. And you're like, and the specialist there's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? I'm like, this is the way I talk. She's like, no, it isn't. Wow. So now I have to be kind of more conscious about how I talk more up here.
Wow.
Because I think a lot of folks, men especially, they want to sound like they're forceful and manly definitely. Down here. But really, my natural voice is probably more up here, you know?
Yeah, man, that's so interesting.
So you live and you learn. Hopefully, you know, I feel it definitely has bounced back finally. But it's you never know what you have until sometimes it disappears.
Ooh, I tell you what, man.
Oh, Miss Sadie, look what you done. Got your man on the run. Leaving and lying, it all feels the same. What's left to do when there's no one to blame? Oh, Sadie, you know what you done. Was it cold?
Let's take it out with another song from the new record, Sadie. I feel like, again, there's this overall thread of loneliness and questioning the character of Sadie is almost someone you're like calling out to, you know, about, you know, almost maybe it's your therapist. I don't know. Who is the character of Sadie for you in this song?
Sadie was this is based off of a true story, slightly. Sadie was this beautiful person I met while I was living out in New Orleans, who was unhappily married, and I was like a young 20 something, real skinny, real naive, and she would come knock on my apartment door and be like, "Hey, Duran, I made crawfish etouffee today. You want to come over?"
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do. And yeah, and so we got to talking about, you know, just how she was very unhappy. We started to create this bond that became intimate. And this is where the story changes. Her husband never found out. If he would find out to this day, he probably would kill me, like straight up. Motherfucker probably like shoot me spot on. And so that's why I called her Sadie. I didn't call her by her real name. And so, yeah, I just wanted to tap on that with this record, because going back to I Want You being like the ultimate form of love and realizing that. But beforehand, I definitely was looking for love in exciting ways and found that, you know, love through infidelity, even though it was like really risky and the risk kind of was thrilling.
Right.
And fun in a way, but it wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it at all. And afterwards, I always felt like crap. Jerry Marie is also about, you know, leaving someone that feeling is also about leaving someone. Mm. And I really do feel like the love songs in this record is really about me, like, pushing, I guess, love aside for music. I Want You is like the, it's like the thing that I just, yeah. So yeah, it's been really interesting, you know, talking about these songs and realizing, you know, what I'm working through, because it's been a process, being vulnerable and putting myself out here in this way and seeing, you know, what I'm gaining from it. It's almost like putting out this record in a way is almost like a therapy session project for myself.
Yeah, I love what you've created here. And, you know, let's just say Mrs. Sadie, you know, her husband doesn't need to know. The funniest story I always remember is this guy who used to play banjo in our group. He's from Missouri, and he accidentally got into this relationship with a woman who was married. He didn't know. And he came back to his hometown in Missouri to play a show with his band. And the guy found out, and I guess the stage in this bar was right against the back was like a window, like a full on like glass window to the parking lot. And all of a sudden he sees the audience kind of being like, oh my God. And he turns around, and this dude who ended up being the husband just started banging on the glass with a hammer.
Oh my.
and then started trying to come through the front. But luckily, like, he had all of his buddies from like the football team that he grew up with, like, at the show, and they just like barricaded the door and like didn't let the guy.
Wow.
And so he just stood behind the stage with like outside with a hammer being like, I know what you did. And he's like, I didn't know she was married. And then he's trying to play, like, you know, continue the show playing the banjo.
Yeah, man. I hope that never happens. Oh, I hope it never happens, man.
I think soul music, you know, whatever you call this, is the genre that is the movement that actually is saying shit and having the courage to really have some big ideas. And that's why I think I've gravitated towards it in my own songwriting. And it's also just, I think, the one of the most timeless parts of American music. It's just something that we need just as much now as we did in the 60s and 70s, you know?
Yeah, much love. And I really appreciate this. Thank you for the opportunity.
Cool, man. Talk to you soon.
All right, peace, bro.
Bye.
Bye.
Big thanks to Duran Jones for getting on the line with me. Wait Till I Get Over is his brand new solo debut record. It's on Dead Oceans. And man, really put this on loud. Get the vinyl. It's a beautiful record. You can go to Duran-Jones.com for his tour dates. He's playing two shows here in LA tonight, May 11th, and tomorrow, Friday, May 12th, at the Masonic Lodge in Hollywood, then going up to the Mill Valley Music Festival in Northern California. He's going to be playing in Japan, in London, in Paris, Seattle, lots of stuff coming up on his website, and he'll be with his group, Duran Jones and the Indications, I'm sure, all over the place. I apologize for my voice being a bit crispy. My 15-month-old, who you heard a little bit on this taping, gave me whatever virus daycare has given her this week. That's just the way it works now. Luckily, I have a few more weeks off until my group Dust Bowl Revival is back on the road. June 8th, we're going to be up at the West Theater in Duluth, Minnesota, and then at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis. June 9th, my hometown of Evanston, Illinois, at Space on the 10th, and then playing Milwaukee, Wisconsin at Collectivo on the 11th. Tell a friend, we're coming their way. If you are still listening this long, I commend you. Well done. My group, Patio Club, our little rock and soul outfit here in LA, will be playing at Hotel Cafe June 3rd, and we might even get some harmonica for my dad, who will be in town. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, and we are part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, stay creative, and we'll see you on the trail.
Grace be with you from the Lord, man. Suited for war, of course, you can never be sure. Left bloody in Lewis and Dennis and the Moors. The aftermath when you put your prejudice before humanity. Let me speak to you candidly. We practicing philanthropy while you taking our families home. Losing my sanity, I struggle showing empathy. Knowing the ones I seek for understanding is an enemy. Crucifying our character is the God.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.